The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is David Field, and I am a Pepper Society member and a supporter of the Free Library. I consider it a great privilege and an honor to stand before you this evening to introduce and welcome Senator John Kerry and Teresa Hines Kerry. Now, before we get started, a couple of notes. Please take a moment to turn off your cell phones, and please, no photographs in the hall. There'll be opportunities for photographs after the session. I'd also like to remind you that there will be a book signing immediately following the event located in the West Gallery on the first floor. Now, of course, our guests this evening really require no introduction at all. Senator Kerry has a long and distinguished record of dedicated and outstanding leadership and public service. A four-term senator from Massachusetts, and of course, the Democratic nominee for president in 2004, he is also the author of a number of books, including The New Soldier and A Call to Service. He has been a tireless and effective leader on a number of issues of great national importance, in areas including foreign relations, the military, healthcare, veterans affairs, fiscal policy, homeland security, and of course, the environment. As a board member of the Wilderness Society in Washington, I have gratefully witnessed his relentless, passionate leadership on a number of environmental issues. During the course of his Senate career, Senator Kerry has fought for clean air, clean water, for whales and other marine mammals, for wilderness protection, and for a serious national commitment to address the issue of climate change. The League of Conservation Voters has lauded him as an environmental champion, and were it not for Senator Kerry, it is highly likely that the battle for the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge would have been lost. He is indeed a true environmental hero. On a personal note, I was privileged to gain a unique insight to Senator Kerry during the presidential campaign. My son Will, who is with us this evening, who was six at the time, spent his summers selling bracelets to raise money for Kerry for president. Will met Senator Kerry at the Franklin Institute in August of 2004 and presented him with $684 in quarters, nickels, dimes, and dollar bills. They had a terrific, lengthy conversation, and from that point forward, Senator Kerry spoke of Will often on the campaign trail. We saw a private side of John Kerry, a warm, endearing, and a gracious gentleman. Interestingly, it was a mutual concern for environmental issues that brought John Kerry and his wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, together. They were introduced at an Earth Day rally in 1990 and then met again in 1992 at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. Teresa Hines Kerry is the chairman of the Howard Hines Endowment and the Hines Family Philanthropies. She is a remarkably talented, compassionate, and generous leader on a number of issues of enormous importance. She was named as one of the nation's leading philanthropists by the New York Times and is one of 100 American visionaries by the Utney Reader for her environmental work. In 2003, she was awarded the Albert Schweitzer Gold Medal for Humanitarianism for her work protecting the environment, promoting health care and education, and uplifting women and children throughout the world. She, too, is a national hero. Senator Kerry and Mrs. Hines Kerry are here this evening to discuss the recently published best-selling book, This Moment on Earth, Today's New Environmentalists and Their Vision for the Future, which they shine the spotlight on a cross-section of today's environmental pioneers who are deploying ingenuity, technology, and sheer will to help save the world we live in. To quote former Vice President Al Gore, John Kerry and Teresa Hines have written a book that is a profound challenge to all of us, but contains in the examples of the men and women who are fighting for the future of our environment the clear hope that if we can embrace their resourcefulness, their determination, and their essential patriotism, we will prevail. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming John Kerry and Teresa Hines Kerry.
Thank you. Thank you. Am I hearing a little feedback? Thank you all very, very much. It's really wonderful to be here, to be back with you. I have, anyway, the fondest memories. I say we because Teresa's had memories from here for a long, long time. But when 110,000 people gathered just down the street with President Clinton at the sort of nearing the end of the campaign, we had one of the high point visits of our campaign anywhere in the country, and we thank you for that, Philadelphia. It was wonderful. Thank you. I know this is a bipartisan audience, which is the way we want it to be, but many of you worked your hearts out and you gave money you didn't have and time you didn't have, and people like Will. I know David already told you about what he did, which is just gargantuan, and I used it as an example across the country, but you did so much. You did everything except move to Ohio. Obviously, that should have been part of our strategy. It's a pleasure to be back here for Teresa and me to talk about this book, which is a passion for both of us. We just had a wonderful moment to stop off over at the Academy of Natural Sciences. Dr. Ruth Patrick, 100 years old, was there. We missed her, unfortunately. She had to leave before we finished. But I was reading her bio when I got there, and I saw that she started her interest in what has been a life's undertaking because her father used to drag her out as a young woman on nature walks. And I felt I wanted to see her and give her a hug because I had this incredible kinship, because my mother used to drag me out at 4 a.m. on these walks. And at that age, believe me, I didn't have a clue how wonderful it was or what was happening, but it did kindle something special in me. And not to mention coming from Massachusetts, where we dig our toes into the clams and the mussels that used to be there and have this extraordinary opportunity to commune with Walden Pond and Ralph Waldo Emerson and the history that surrounds us. So it's a pleasure to come here and share some thoughts with you about this book that Therese and I partnered on. And candidly, I think she wrote the best chapter in the book, which she will talk about a bit, which is chapter 2 and chapter 1. That talks about toxins and chemicals and what's happening to the largest organ of our body, which is your skin, unwittingly every single day without even knowing it, and the different standards. And I'll say a few words about all of that. But this book is an outgrowth of the experience that we had during the course of the campaign and our lifetime. And during the campaign, in every state that we went, we did an environmental event, bar none. Every state we went to, we talked about issues, usually that were understandable and local to the state, but also national. So in West Virginia, for example, we talked about clean coal technology. In Iowa, we talked about confined animal farm operations, CAFOs as they're known, and these unbelievable factory operations with hogs and so forth that spill enormous amounts of waste into the rivers and so on. Minnesota, we did wind power. California, alternative energy, offshore drilling, a host of biofuels, ethanol, etc. Washington, nuclear spill into the Columbia River, the dams, salmon, fish. You name it, there's a part of our country that faces its own special challenge. In New Hampshire, we talked about the MBTE that goes into the lakes, that is polluting their lakes. An additive in gasoline, incidentally, that we've put in, everybody thinking, oh boy, wouldn't this be good, it'll lower the lead, but on the other hand, what else does it do when they don't think about it, and we inherit the consequences. Consequences are what this book is about. And responsibility in terms of how you avoid the consequences of the future, facing the enormous array of challenges that we face with respect to the environment. Now, let me just say to you up front that the experience in all those states brought us beyond the frustration of losing the election itself, which is an obvious frustration, particularly given the last few years. We came out of it and we sort of talked to each other about it, but we also had friends who came up to us and said, why didn't you talk about the environment more? Well, we did. It just didn't break through. In addition to which, we had a lot of people who came, who were beginning to question the environment as an issue. In fact, two people joined together to write an article, the title of which was, Is Environmentalism Dead? Well, with that title, we sort of got to work. We looked at each other and said, this is crazy. We have this unbelievable set of challenges. We've got to get people to connect the dots and take these challenges into the voting booth with them. And the question is, how do you get them to do that? And so we wrote this book as a way of saying, no, environmentalism isn't dead, but more importantly, as a way of trying to connect the dots for people in red states, blue states, purple states, for everybody to understand we're all connected to this. This has no relationship to Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal. It's without those labels. And we have to see this as Americans. It's sort of interesting that a few moments ago over there, we were looking at Lewis and Clark plants sent back from the expedition that a great president, Thomas Jefferson, understood because of his affection, love, passion for the natural sciences, was an important part of who we are and of how we define ourselves and what we needed to understand about ourselves. This book is easy to read, and it is not a sort of dump on you all the woes and perils alone that we face. It's a book of optimism. It's a book that shows you individual stories of different people across the country who don't define themselves as environmentalists, but who are seizing the initiative and going out and making an enormous difference in their community and in the life around us. This is a book about heroes. It's a book about possibilities. It's a book about hope. It's a book about the future if we're smart enough to seize the choices that are staring us in the face. We thought, in fact, to try to get people interested in it, we would call it something like Harry Potter and the Environment. But the rights were already taken, so we couldn't do that. Instead, what you have are 254 pages of recycled Alberto Gonzalez emails. Actually, I wish they were. We couldn't find them. So let me talk for a few minutes about what's really in this book and what's really facing every single one of you as we think about the future here. I'll leave the toxins and chemicals to Trey. And I will let her describe to you, because it's a very important part of what we have to do in the future, the story of your own state, Pittsburgh, and what she and others did in Pittsburgh as an example of what we could do in cities all across the country to hold on to this future. So, but this is not a book about global climate change alone. There is a chapter on global climate change, and I want to talk about it because it is a dominant, overwhelming challenge to all of us. Generational, lifetime, existential. I mean, it's huge. But it's not insurmountable. And that's part of what we want people to understand in this book. We also write about the distribution of political power and how that has an impact on people's lives and choices and on their wellness and on their health. Particularly the story, and it's very important in the context of Philadelphia and other urban centers that people think about this. We happen to focus on New York, on the Bronx, where a young woman by the name of Majora Carter, who lived in the Bronx all her life, grew up with an ambition, which was to leave the Bronx, not be in it. She got, because of her qualifications, she earned a scholarship to go to Wesleyan. She went to Wesleyan, and she graduated and came back to NYU to go to graduate school. At NYU, she couldn't afford to live in New York, as most young people have a difficult time doing today, so she went home to the Bronx to live with her family. But because of the education she'd received, her eyes had been opened, and she went back and saw a different Bronx. She saw a Bronx that was on Hunts Point, right on the river, even though you couldn't really see it or enjoy it or get to it, which is part of what she now saw. And she had a sense of outrage about that. And she saw a Bronx, which was a site for waste transfer facility after waste transfer facility. And it became the alternative route for diesel trucks to drive through, so that the air quality was less than it ought to have been and was in other parts of the city. And so she fought back individually, all alone. She just said, I'm not going to stand for this. We can change this. And she went out and began to organize people politically. First, just demonstrate to get attention. And she got people walking down the street with garbage bags and other things to sort of highlight what was happening in terms of the waste transfer facility. She got the politicians involved after a while. She proved through numbers that there's political clout. And ultimately, she started something called Sustainable Bronx. She stopped the next waste transfer facility from being put in there. She got the riverfront cleaned up. She's now working on parks and housing. And she won a MacArthur Award, Genius Award, as a consequence of the work that she undertook. It's a great story of possibilities, of one person just sort of seizing the initiative and making a difference. Another example are these CAFOs that I talked about a moment ago. There's a story in the book of a fellow by the name of Rick Dove. Rick Dove was a career Marine, did his 30 years, two tours of duty in Vietnam, certainly served his country and had earned the right to retire. He goes to North Carolina, to the Neuse River, and he wants to be a fisherman with his son. They buy three boats and they go out to fish. Lo and behold, while they're fishing, they discover their hands are breaking out and their legs in these lesions, open sores. Their fellow fishermen are having memory loss and even passing out, some of them having difficulties finding their way back home. So they, you know, he's not content just to sort of say, this is the way it is. He says, what's going on? And he goes out, not the state, not the attorney general, not the EPA. He goes out and tracks it down and finds that these huge hog operations are in North Carolina alone dumping as much hog waste directly into the water as human waste is produced in all of California, Texas, Pennsylvania, New York, and North Dakota put together. What happened to the Clean Water Act? What happened to sort of common sense of science and testing and what happens to people? So they, through the nitrate overload and what was happening, the fisteria, the growth of these, you know, algae organisms, was creating a toxicity that you didn't even have to come into contact with, though they were, and it would create this neuro system response in human beings. So they fought back. They got the law applied. They managed to change what was happening in North Carolina. And to the credit of North Carolina, they're now working on trying to contain this, but still not sufficiently contained because they dump it in lagoons. The lagoons leak. They still spread it, ultimately, on fields as a manure, and when the rain comes, it washes off into the estuaries, the rivers, and so it is that 39% of all the rivers in the United States of America today are contaminated. 45% of all the lakes and 49% of all our estuaries are contaminated. Are you content with that? Is any American content with that? Kids do not have the right to enjoy the great national transitional pastime of going fishing with your parents, and if you're lucky enough to catch the fish, eat them. In 19 states, you are forbidden from eating the fish. In 44 states, there are warnings against eating the fish because of the levels of chemicals, be it mercury or whatever, PCBs. I mean, there's a whole list of things that have been dumped into water and still is. Gasoline that spills off from construction sites. Rain comes, down it goes, sewer overflows, can't handle it. It's dumped raw out into many of the water bodies of the United States. And we used to have a partnership under the Clean Water Act, which we began in the 1970s, that would respond to this. The partnership was about 90% money funding from the federal government, 10% from the locals or state, or 80%. Today, you're lucky if you can get 10% from the state or federal government. And so local communities, because of the property tax problems, have to walk away completely, and we're not doing what we were 20 and 30 years ago to protect the water of the United States of America. Now, we could. There's all kinds of technology available and all kinds of ability to be able to do it. And the impact of that on the health of America is significant. Increasingly, Teresa will again talk a little more about sort of what scientists are learning and producing now in terms of environmental impact on cancer, leukemia, neurosystem growth disorders, different immune system problems that we're dumping. I'll just give an example. This is not a human example, but it's relevant because it's a living organism. In the Anacostia River, and I think in the Chesapeake Bay, in the last couple of years, they have found male fish with female genitalia. Totally as a consequence of the mutation that has taken place as a result of the chemicals in the water. Now, the people most exercise this about are conservatives, who are very worried that male fish may be able to produce children, and that would have a really bad problem. That could set us back. I'm only joking. But think about the implications. Think about the implications of that. That you have this huge percentage of places where we have this threat. I mean, I can think in Massachusetts of New Bedford Harbor, for instance, where we still haven't cleaned up the PCBs. Now, we write in the book about these stunning examples. One of the greatest of all is the Hudson River, where, again, a group of Marines returned from World War II to find what was happening as the oil dumping was taking place directly into the river and other problems, the Indian Point plant and other things. They fought back against it, discovering an ancient law from the 1800s which could actually hold people accountable, and they went to court. They went to court and got the law upheld and actually got it cleaned up. And today, GE and other people are continuing to do some of the cleanup, but we've restored the striped bass and other species that have now returned, and the Hudson River now stands as one of the great reclamation examples on the planet. So we can do this, folks. We did it with striped bass in Massachusetts. We're going to lose them. And we put a 10-year ban on the fishing of striped bass. Now you can go out there and find keepers, 36 inches bigger. It's unbelievable what's happened to striped bass fishing. We're going through a crisis on fishing in every major fishery in the world today. Why? Two reasons. There's too much money chasing too few fish, and the pollution and what's happening to the ecosystem. So we've got this enormous challenge to try to preserve this fabulous ecosystem celebrated over there at the Academy and elsewhere in America, which is our future. And what's happening is we, in this book, write about evangelicals and others in America who are beginning to understand that that this is part of caring about creation. This is part, if you're religious, you can read the Torah or the Quran or the Bible or be a Confucianist or a Hindu or whatever. There is no value system within a religion or a philosophy of living that does not have at its core a respect for our environment. And so you cannot truly practice any of those, if you claim to be, without showing greater respect than we are showing today. Now, let me come to this sort of big issue that's facing us, the big challenge, and then I'm going to have Teresa pick up, and then we'd love to just do Q&A and spend as much time as we can answering questions. Air quality, similarly, we've gone backwards on. Because the Bush administration, and again, it's not partisan, it's just a noting a fact, we had what were called new source performance standards, so that any coal-fired plant had to, if it did a retrofit, put state-of-the-art quality technology in to reduce the emissions from that plant. And those new source performance standards were being enforced until a few years ago, when the Bush administration relaxed them, and now there is more pollution going up to do more greenhouse gases, more particulates in the air, which affects people with emphysema, kids with asthma. 25% of all the kids in Harlem have asthma. The biggest cause of hospitalizations in the summertime for children is asthma attacks. So we have unwanted, unnecessary expenses in the healthcare system as a consequence of what we're not doing to continue to clean up the air, not to mention lives cut short and exacerbated illnesses in people who shouldn't have them. Now, we were making progress in the 1970s. And I'll come to sort of where that came from as I close. But let me come back to this issue we're facing now. I want to try to put it in very clear terms and then talk to you about what the alternative is and sit down. Climate change. Why do we call it greenhouse gases? Why do we talk about a greenhouse effect? The simple answer is that were it not for the greenhouse effect, we would not be here. It is the greenhouse effect on the planet Earth that in fact makes life possible, because it keeps the Earth's temperature at an average temperature of 57 degrees Fahrenheit, at least now, warming, which is critical for life. It would be 60 degrees colder without the greenhouse effect. Now, what is the greenhouse effect? Why is it called that? It's because it's like a greenhouse. Anybody who's seen a greenhouse at a farm, at a nursery, or you know, occasionally you see them in, you know, some gardens here and there, because the light that comes through it from the sun goes through transparently. It's a transparent penetration of the Earth's atmosphere. And it therefore comes through at a wavelength, in a short wave, that is very much more powerful. It goes down, hits whatever it hits on Earth. If it hits the ice cap, a lot of it bounces back up because it's reflected. If it hits hard Earth, it goes in, warms the Earth, creates its own energy in all the ways we know and understand, goes into the ocean. A lot of it gets absorbed into the ocean. It warms wherever it's going in. So what's happening, when it bounces back and goes back as the reflected energy or as energy produced from something, it goes back opaque. It does not penetrate the Earth's atmosphere the way it came in, because it goes back in a different wavelength, goes back a long wavelength, and doesn't have the penetrative ability. I'm sort of simplifying this, but it's essentially what happens. And the result is it gets trapped. The heat gets trapped. You want that in a greenhouse, because you're trying to grow your tomatoes. You're trying to have the extra heat and grow it. But on Earth, as we've added gases on an increasing level to that trap, we're getting warmer. That's basically what's happening. And scientists have traced that warming going way back thousands of years by drilling into the ice cores, taking out the ice bores, and looking at, and you know, being able to measure the level of oxygen, carbon dioxide, et cetera, in the ice. And they could tell how warm it was. They can tell what the carbon dioxide levels were. Well, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, folks, call it around the 1850s or so, 1860s, we had a level of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere of about 370 parts per million of the atmosphere was greenhouse gas. And that's natural. There's a lot of natural production of greenhouse gas. Deforestation produces carbon dioxide. You have natural carbon dioxide in the Earth. So there's always been a natural level of carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide, which is the principal greenhouse gas, it's not the only one. Methane, is halocarbons, there are other six or seven whatever greenhouse gases. But the principal one, two principal ones that are most damaging are carbon dioxide and methane. And so we went from 270, we're now at about 370. Right now, at this point in time, 370, 380 parts per million. So you've gone up 100 or so over the span of the Industrial Revolution. Now here's what's scary. We are about to build 100 pulverized coal-powered plants here in the United States over the course of the next 30 years, 20 years, or less. China is about to build one pulverized or two pulverized coal-fired plant per week in the next years, just right now, while we're sitting here. India, likewise. If they all do it and we all do it, you can forget about doing something about global climate change. Forget it. You have to. The scientists now tell us, 2,000 plus scientists have come together. And these scientists, through the International panel on global climate change, sponsored by the United Nations, but thousands of scientists. So many of whom I've met and talked with, very, very reputable people. People, you know, like Bob Correll, who happens to be the Heinz Center in resident scientist, or John Holdren, who's a professor of earth sciences at Harvard and at Woods Hole Institute. And people's career and life is put into finding science, scientific fact, have all concluded with 90% certainty that the warming that is taking place because of what we are doing, and that it is absolutely to a certainty warming. Now, if you got on an airplane to fly somewhere tomorrow and the pilot got on the loudspeaker and said, "Welcome aboard, there's a 10% chance we're going to get where we're going," you'd get off the plane, wouldn't you? That's exactly where we are with respect to Earth. 90% certain, and yet we have people in Washington still, even in the United States Senate, who question the science, don't want to move because of money and power and politics and all the rest of it. Now we've got 150 plus nations that have come together. Every environment minister, prime minister, president, trade minister, finance minister have all agreed we've got to do something about this. Only the United States of America has been resisting and is resisting at this moment. Now, why do you have to do something? You have to do something because the scientists are telling us. Whereas 2 years ago, and I have followed this, for Al Gore and I held the first hearings on global climate change in 1987 in the Senate, in the Commerce Committee. Together, we went down to Rio in 1992 to the Earth Summit with Senator John Chafee and Senator Tim Wirth of Colorado and others. And my wife, who I was not then my wife, we met sort of there in Rio, she was a non-governmental organization appointee of George Herbert Walker Bush, and all of us were there in agreement in 1992 that we had to do something about this, and we created a voluntary framework to do something, and even George Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, signed it, and the world got on board. 17 years later, we still haven't done anything near what we said we were going to do and promised to do. And I went to all the subsequent conferences in Rio, in Buenos Aires, in The Hague. I was in Kyoto with the negotiations. So I've followed this for a long time. And here is what is lacking in the argument of the other side. They have two obligations, ladies and gentlemen. If they're going to not move and do something, they have an obligation to show what is causing the warming if, in fact, it isn't the greenhouse gases. And secondly, they have an obligation to show how the greenhouse gases are not doing what the scientists say they are doing. And they have done neither of the two. They can do neither of the two. And right now, there are 928 peer-reviewed studies that document what is happening. Peer-reviewed meaning anonymous, reviewed by fellow scientists as to the methodology and conclusions. 928 to zero. Not one peer-reviewed study says otherwise. So, we have to do something. And I'm passionate about this. I've been having meetings in the Senate. I'm working this on a constant basis. And this book talks about what we can do. And guess what? It's what we can do and do so much better as a nation if we do it. It's what we can do and make money, create new jobs, be healthier, be more secure. I mean, the bottom line is, if Al Gore is wrong and 2,000 plus scientists are wrong and I'm wrong and everybody, what's the worst that would happen if we took a response to do something about this? Worst that would happen is America has better, cleaner air to breathe. We create a lot of new technologies we can sell to China and India and other countries. A lot of new jobs, a lot of new wealth would be created. We'd have less kids go to the hospital, less asthma, have cleaner air, cleaner water, more fishing. And guess what? We'd be more energy independent and therefore have greater security for the United States of America. That's the downside. What's the downside if they're wrong? Species destroyed, ocean currents perhaps lost, moved, who knows what, can't predict it. Moving the forests, loss of water bodies, whole parts of our country maybe in drought for years and arid and so forth. You can't even conjured. I mean, I cannot tell you all of it except that you can see the logic of how all of that can happen, because it is happening right now. So the bottom line, and I'll end on this, is this book is about the positive of all this, because the truth is, if we do what we know we can do with American ingenuity, we can go out there, folks, and literally lead the world to these new technologies, to a cleaner world. I'll give you an example. For 1 week's payment of the war in Iraq, we could afford to pay every gas station in America. We could install an alternative fuel pump. And people would actually be able to say, I can buy a car like that with E85 because I know where I can fill it up. You'd change the buying habits. You'd change what happens in Detroit. You'd begin to create a market where there isn't one today. There are all kinds of things like that could be consequences of these choices we face. There are three big ways that you actually deal with global climate change, and only three that are big. One, energy efficiency. We haven't begun to scratch the surface in America of energy efficiency. I was in a hotel in Europe not so long ago, come out of my room, you shut the door, it's dark, all of a sudden lights go on. You walk down the hall, the lights progressively get brighter in the direction you're walking, and they're going down behind you. You get to the elevator, you get in the elevator, the lights go out in the hall. You go to Japan or other countries, you get to the escalator, it's not working, and you say to yourself, wow, this must be broken, we better call the management. Before you do that, you get near it and it starts. It's working because an infrared light turns it on. You get to the bottom, if nobody else is coming behind you, it shuts off. Our escalators are just going ka-chung, 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 ka-chung. And so is the dollars and cents of the people who are paying for the energy. We actually reward people for using more energy in America, not less. That's how the electricity rates are sold. So we can change all of this. We can have new industries created on the new technologies for energy efficiency. I'll give you a great example. Texas Instruments was about to go to China, out of Texas, in Dallas. And their employees, obviously, were apoplectic. We don't want to lose our jobs. So they got Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute to come down because they challenged the architects and engineers and said, look, if you can save us the amount of money that we'd save by going to China so we can be competitive, we'll stay. So they redesigned the plant. They lowered it by one floor, two floors instead of three. They created pipes that were designed straight instead of those big bent elbows you see through a building, which takes a lot more energy to drive the fluid through it. They used materials that were energy efficient. They created climate control, water control. And in the end, ladies and gentlemen, they were able to make a net bottom line savings for that company that allowed them to stay, keep 88,000 jobs, produce $14 billion conglomerate for the economy, and ultimately, they are saving something like $3 million bucks a year. Well, now DuPont, Dow Chemical, 3M, Walmart, a whole bunch of companies, Lehman Brothers and others, have come together and said, we've got to do this all across the country. And we can do green building. Every building that goes up should be built with new design and new concepts for energy savings. And we can save a huge amount. That's number one. Number two, alternative and renewable fuels. You all know a lot about that. You're beginning to see that argument. Ethanols, different sources of fuel, wind, power, solar, etc. One big venture capitalist out in California is producing a thermal, solar thermal plant for power, which will use solar heating mirrors to heat the fluid that will then turn the generators, and it'll be entirely free from solar coming in and creating power. You don't need the coal in his case. There are many people who are beginning to argue that in 5 or 10 years, with the right research and development commitment, we may have complete alternatives to fossil fuels. So we got to push the curve like we did to go to the moon, or like we did to create an atom bomb to end World War II. I mean, we can do these things, but you've got to have the leadership that believes in it and is committed to it and willing to do it. The third big thing is clean coal technology. I'll say it to you bluntly. We cannot build these pulverized coal-fired plants anymore unless they can capture carbon and store it. To do otherwise is to just get on this roller coaster towards this unbelievable confrontation with a reality you don't want to imagine. So those are the three biggies, folks. And we've got to all go and make it happen. And the way you do it is to connect the dots for your friends and get involved. Be like Will over here, who got out there during the summer and raised a lot of money and, you know, tried to put me in the White House to make a difference. And I'll tell you, as a young six-year-old, he made a lot more difference than an awful lot of 60-year-olds in our country, some of whom didn't even bother to vote. So that's what it takes. Earth Day 1970 was my first real political involvement when I came back from Vietnam, not the war. And I remember 20 million Americans came out on one single day because they were tired of seeing the Cuyahoga River light on fire, tired of seeing toxic waste sites take lives and so forth. And 20 million people changed the face of the country by then focusing their energy on 12 congressmen. They were labeled the Dirty Dozen. And in the next election, 7 of those 12 congressmen were beaten. There is nothing like seeing your colleagues lose to concentrate the mind of somebody up in the next cycle. And that's what happened. Passed the Clean Air Act, safe drinking water, marine mammal protection, coastal zone management, clean air, all of them passed, and we created the Environmental Protection Agency. We didn't even have one until 1972 when Richard Nixon signed it into existence. It didn't happen because somebody in Washington gave it to you. It happened because individuals like the individuals we write about in this book said, we're going to make this happen. And that's why we wrote this book. That's what we hope you will be encouraged and inspired to go do. On that note, let me introduce to you someone who to this day, I am convinced, would have been an absolutely spectacular First Lady of our land, Teresa Einstein.
You forgot to say why this moment.
I know, you tell me.
No. I don't know how to follow that and do it in a short time, especially since I carry such a load of tough things to say. But I also carry a load of good things to say and hopeful. John mentioned the deadly toxins and disease, but he also mentioned greening and Pittsburgh and possibilities. And so I like to start with possibilities first, because it's just, it opens the door nicely. And a lot of you on this side of the state know or have read about what Pittsburgh was like. Dirty as hell. I mean, it was, what's the budget? It was a city, it was hell with a lid, with a lid off. That's how it was described. And it was. Great people, a lot of industry, great industrial history, but making the kind of mistakes that people don't understand consequences do. And so we are paying the price for a lot of unintended consequences. Nobody's fault necessarily, at least initially, but it's not acceptable to continue to do certain things today when we know the science, period. Just not acceptable. So I have been fortunate to have made Pittsburgh my home as a young bride in 1966, of having had a husband who went to Congress in 1971, young, loved nature, loved fishing, and loved the environment that way. And then dealing with OSHA and the miners and Clean Air Act, and also realizing that there were a lot of unacceptable relationships between what miners went through and their health and insurances, etc. Very involved in that, and therefore began to understand what was going to happen when the Clean Air Act came up, and was part of that before he died by that vote. I went with him and Al Gore in 1968 to Brazil, to the Amazonian forest, and sleeping there and seeing the burning of the forest. Great concern on global climate change issues. And then he passed away in 91, and I went in 92, appointed by George Bush Sr. to Brazil. These things are important only because I have seen a huge transformation in Pittsburgh. And I did intervene there when I took over the endowments, the Heinz endowments, in 91 after my husband died, and decided with our trustees that we were going to put some criteria in our grants that were not actually even understood by some of our trustees, but I explained to them. And basically, we assumed the responsibility for not enabling or being part of creation of more mistakes, whether building bad buildings that or on bad sites, not cleaned up sites, not safe sites, or on creating programs that enabled health patterns that were good for people. Whatever, we set a standard, and we went about it gently. We also tried to prevent some behavior that was not any intention at all, was not even properly programmed. We have 102 municipalities in Allegheny County, and there's no regulation that has any kind of responsibility on the behavior of one versus another. So being very shale and very up and down, very steep, a lot of the toxic stuff that comes from one area comes right down and hits every little village down the or a little town down the hill. Terrible problems. But people didn't know the science, and they didn't know it. So we began to make a big transformation in the dialogue, in the sense of responsibility of one mayor to another, in the sense of possibilities, and if possible, in understanding the science in terms of health. And today, I have to say that Pittsburgh, in 1994, I moved into my office in Pittsburgh from an old office that we had to move out of. And it was a top floor of an existing building, not occupied. And Bill McDonough was an amazing philosopher architect, was dean of UVA's architecture school after that, not then, helped design. And it was the first green office space in Pittsburgh. And we moved in January 94. The contractor that worked with us, Mr. Mascaro, didn't even know what environmental green architecture meant, nor did the workers. Discovery Channel was very interested in this and filmed the building of the office, talking to those workers, asking them questions. Do you know what you're doing? Why you're doing it? What does it mean? How much does this cost? Etc. And then we enabled, again, through the endowments, the creation of the Green Building Alliance and other agencies or groups of people or councils where people who knew and cared about these issues could really leverage and teach others. And by January 2004, Pittsburgh was the leading green city in the United States with 60 LEED sites, big LEED. Today, we have LEED buildings. We have a lot of sites, like my office is not a building, it's a site. We have the largest green building in the world, our convention center, designed by Ralph Vignoli, processes its own waste, a lot of the water, passive heating, beautiful building. We are building right now the biggest and most wonderful children's hospital, not just green in building, but green in practice. How do you disinfect a hospital green? We are creating probably, I hope, a green chemistry center in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh, for the creation of new products that are benevolent, that will kill all kinds of bacteria and things in a benevolent fashion. Terry Collins at CMU, and who I'm sure will win a Nobel Prize, a New Zealander, and also at Pitt. We have probably some of the top green chemists in the world right there in Pittsburgh. So there's a lot of stuff going on. It's very exciting. At University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC, which, like Philadelphia, you know, we are blessed in our state to have three great centers of medicine. The new Hillman Cancer Institute has, and again, it came out of work we were doing with some of the scientists, doctors, probably the only, as far as I know, environmental oncology center, a research center in the country that they devoted to that. And for us, it's particularly important because of our industrial history and the diseases that have been related to a lot of our industry. But what they're looking for is If you're interested, I'm going back to toxins now, the ugly part. But I want to give you the good news. They're looking at, for instance, the excuses that you normally get, which is, oh, this is only, you know, 1/10 of a part per million of something. It's not going to affect you if you're exposed to it. Well, the only problem is, we are born today. A baby is born with about 150 particulates, cancer-causing chemicals, toxins. It's born with that. Now, that baby may be okay because it's properly fed. The mother takes care of it. It's not exposed to a lot of things. But we are seeing a lot of disease happening to children that shouldn't be. We are seeing too many women, more than men, getting huge amounts of cancer now from exposure to household cleaning products, cosmetics, and beauty, other beauty products, personal care products. Now, the reason this is, and this is now factual, we can show you the studies, and it's unacceptable. Women don't know. Most people don't know. And in our book in the back, we give you not only the reference to the studies, but we also, so if you want to read the studies, you can, but who to go to get help and reference. So it's not going to give you a whole bunch of ugly stuff and leave you alone. For instance, I'll give you one thing quickly that will just stop, make you think. Now, men also know what estrogens are. Women certainly all do. And we've all read about estrogen replacement therapy and breast cancer and all of those things because it's been in the news a lot. Well, do you know what's the main ingredient in shampoo for curly hair? Placenta.
For hair straightener. Hair straightener.
Hair straightener, yeah, for curly hair, to straighten hair. Right, to straighten hair. And some days I feel like I have it when the weather's bad and goes... But anyway, I don't use the placenta. But people also don't realize that the skin is our largest organ and that anything we put on our skin goes straight through our body. So we're having now young women, white, African-American, with a huge rise on breast cancer, very young. And they've been looking at why? Well, they kept thinking, what is it that young women today are doing more than they used to? And what is in the products that they're using? And they went to personal care products and cosmetics. There's an age when women do a lot of that stuff. They're young. And today, and I'll give you an example, there are products being used, or chemicals being used in these products, that are, I guess, have a better outcome. They stay longer, they stick to you, they don't chip, your nail polish doesn't chip, like OPI, don't use it. It's got formaldehyde and phthalates, don't use it. There are others that don't. But those things are cancer-causing. Now, what they have found is that women, well, for African-American women particularly, who, if they straighten their hair, it's a terrible thing. And for the first time, African-American young women are getting more breast cancer than white women. That's not been the norm. Young little girls are getting menses much younger if they wear those things, use the shampoo. So that study is about to come out. But it's there at the oncological study. They've got the stuff. They're looking at it. So I'm giving you an example that touches us every day. So a woman gets up in the morning and she, you know, she has a shower. And she has a shower curtain that has phthalates or PVC or something like that. Not all plastic is bad, but a lot of it is. She's exposed to those fumes with the steam. Don't use plastics to cook with. Walter Reed Medical Center right this week sent out it's almost like it came out of our book, but it didn't. Of course, they know it. What not to do, what not to use. Cook an old-fashioned Pyrex or something else, but do not use plastics. Most plastics have phthalates and other problems. They're terrible. So I'm not going to list all the diseases they do, but it's not good enough to have children's leukemia go up soaring. to have an answer that says, but we have a much better rate of cure. And thank goodness we do. That's not good enough. What is more important is, why are they getting the leukemia, and let's stop that. Because we don't know enough yet what the impact of the cure will be 20 years from now in terms of some organ damage or something. We don't know. But also, why put children through that? Why put families through that? What UPMC is doing now is looking at the concoction, what I call a cocktail, of say 16 or 18 or 20 of these little tiny little bits of this together in a particular person versus another person. What is the impact of that cocktail? And that's what no one has measured yet. And they're doing that. And it's important, because what they hope to do when they get there is to be able to look at a person's sample and say, all right, this person really should be eating these foods, turmeric or ginger or whatever it is that the person needs, and they are looking at it in a very holistic way. And this is a very sophisticated group of oncologists and researchers. They are trying to show us how to be healthy and figure out what's causing the problem and how that works in your body. So it's very exciting to me. I don't like where we are. I believe in preventive medicine. My dad was an oncologist. I grew up in Africa. And in Africa, I learned as a little girl, when he used to take me on rounds, to understand causality, to understand how some native people survived and some others did not as easily. And also its relationship with nature. And if you don't respect nature and its laws, whether it's about animals and their behavior or about mosquitoes and or bilharzia and water, whatever it is, you die. You die. So I learned to be an environmentalist, although I never knew what that word was. I just thought, you know, prevention, smarts, healthy. And that's what took me to environment. And I dare say that 20 years ago, no one called themselves environmentalists that I know of. We were either health advocates or, you know, nature lovers or duck hunters or whatever we were. But we cared. And what we try to do with this book is to call on those people to go to that place of their lives where they react or care about certain things, whatever they are, and not feel daunted by the fact that they're not, quote, important, because they are very important. And the most important thing we all have to contribute here is really our notion of fairness, of moral rectitude, of hope and determination. That's what it takes. And so the people we celebrate in this book, the new environmentalists, are people that have that about themselves. They didn't maybe know it or even think about it, but when faced with a situation, by golly, they did the thing that needed to be done. And they're wonderful people. I will give you one little story. I mean, so many wonderful stories here, but I'll give you a story about diapers. Why not? So many in the world. Diapers were designed by a woman, an editor, in Connecticut about 60 years ago. The Bota, sold at Saks Fifth Avenue. And then the companies that made disposable diapers went on from there and made them, you know, into Loves and Huddles and whatever it is. My kids had the old-fashioned cloth diapers, and I did a lot of diaper washing. Boraxo and pails and water and etc. was fine. I went to Africa with a suitcase full of diapers with my little babies to visit my family. Those were the days. So, a young couple in Portland, he's Australian, Graham Nyes, they've got a double barrel name. And I met them in Portland the other day. He came out of a meeting like this at the end. He came around and says, I'm Graham Nye, and I got the diaper. I said, oh my God, the G diaper. Well, let me just give you a couple of statistics. There are about 18 million?
Billion.
Not billion, pounds. Anyway, 18 billion. Whatever, it's 18. disposable diapers in waste dump sites. It's the third biggest item in a dump site.
$18 billion a year.
Okay. Thank you, sir. 18, as I said. $18 billion. It's 82,000 tons.
Correct.
Of plastic, which a lot of which is made from crude oil. It uses about 250,000 trees for the paper, and it takes 500 years to biodegrade. 500. So, what did this wonderful couple do? They created a diaper, like a pant, made of a good plastic. And then they have a liner, strong liner, good liner. It has no dioxins, it has no chemicals, no chlorines, nothing. It's so safe that when you take it out, you can throw it in the loo, or you can take it and rinse it and compost it in your garden. And it biodegrades in 150 days. These are the practical things that Americans can do and will do when called to a higher place and feel that they have the possibility to do it. So I believe, I have tremendous faith and optimism that our ingenuity, our history as people who look on the bright side of things and go get them, that all of these things will enable us to surmount this. It is sad we don't have national leadership. Yes, it is. But I hope that the people of this country and their own zest for righteousness and for smartness and for competitiveness will surmount and will overcome that problem. But I have faith. And it is very exciting to be with these people, as I have been, with the people who work on cancer, the women in the Cape Cod, and there's just wonderful people out there. And they honored us by coming to here and talk with us, and we are saying thank you to them and encouraging them to go on and hoping that you all join them and read the book and read these stories and tell your kids about them, because we need the kids. This is for the kids. I dedicated this book to my grandchild and to all the grandchildren in the world with a heart full of resolute hope. That's my message.
There's something wrong with your mic, so I want you to use this one. And I'll just, we're going to move it on. And I'll just run the Q&A for you.
Thank you. So, on the... Is this working? Hello? Is that working? No. Is that working?
All?
Test one. There it is. So on the cheery note of diapers, we would love to answer some questions before we have a chance to visit and sign some books and say hello to everybody. Shoot. Yes.
I'm always trying to convince people to recycle, to not take plastic bags from stores, to reuse, and I can make no headway with people I know from age 6 to age 66 and above. And yet when I hear you, I wonder if it matters.
It does matter. In fact, we were in Portland, Oregon, and a fellow jumped up, same place where this fellow on the diapers could jump up. He said, you know, I've started to make my own decision, and I never go anywhere and take a bag out of the place. I take my own bags to go out and shop. Now, it'll take time. You do it by example, you do it by discussion. It would be wonderful if we had civic leadership in each of these communities where the mayor, the city council, the congressman, whoever locally, really go out and try and talk about this and show how it does make a difference. In the conglomerate, it makes an enormous difference. I'll give you an example. You know, just changing your light bulbs. Because some people think, it didn't make a big difference. Well, one light bulb, the old incandescent light bulb, over its lifetime produces about half a ton of carbon dioxide. Now, the new light bulbs last 10 times longer and put out a minuscule, they're either completely clean or a minuscule proportion of that kind of emission. So you can make an enormous difference if you change three or four light bulbs that are the most used light bulbs in your home. And likewise, just your driving habits. You know, I have a friend in Washington. He's a lawyer. He owns a Prius. And he has retrofitted the Prius with a battery, a lithium battery, designed by a company in Massachusetts called A123. And you can go online and check the company out. And the battery, it still costs. It costs about $3,500 to put the battery in and get it retrofitted. But he gets 150 miles to the gallon. Now, figure out the cost of that over a year or two of driving, and you'll figure out you can pay for this thing. Not to mention what you do in terms of reducing emissions as a result of not using as much gasoline. So your emissions are down, even though you haven't changed the tailpipe itself in emissions quality. So all of these things make a difference. And it's a matter of, as I said, and Teresa said, connecting the dots for people. It takes time, but civic leadership, which puts incentives out there, stores. I'll give you an example. Why don't you make it a challenge in your community? Start going to the managers and owners of the grocery stores and get them involved in helping to promote this at the store. Maybe they sell at very low cost or at cost alternative bags that people can buy and say, have your own bag, or get it in engraved, or, you know, whatever. And they come back and it says their name or something. Whatever. There are all kinds of ways to excite people and market this stuff. We're a marketing country. And if you market this properly, people will begin to grab it. One of the things I have always believed that immediately post 9/11 was a huge moment of opportunity for a president to ask the country to join in something so we weren't dependent on sending billions of dollars to a bunch of countries in the Middle East that see a lot of it go to terrorism. That would make sense. And if we did a few things like that, we could change our behavior quickly.
Can I add something? I'd like to add something. Thank you. I try to do what you're talking about, you know, bags, etc., in a not very progressive state, not to call it somewhere out west. And I went to the manager. I mean, I've been going there off and on. I went to talk to him, and I said, do you know that there are better alternatives than this? Don't cost more. He said, well, why is this bad? So I explained to him why. This was about 12 years ago, why it was bad. And I took one of those old, you know, bags we use in Europe, those little net, fishnet things. And I said, we could have that. You could have all kinds of things. That doesn't take any space. But I wasn't threatening. I just told him. He'd never heard of anything like this. Within a month, he had corn oil bags, you know, not the bad plastic ones. And he had the little bags. And they asked people, do you want paper, or do you want to buy one of these bags, or do you want the corn oil ones? So I think if you get 6, 7, or 8 friends who shop at the same place that you do, and you together go and talk to them, whether because they don't sell enough of one kind of a thing or another, you have a huge impact. And if they keep just saying no to you, you'll say, well, I'm going to change stores. You know?
Anybody else?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to know...
Why don't you wait for the mic, and then everybody else can share your... There you go.
Thank you. I wanted to know, when we go to the voting booth in our city elections, local elections, and also national elections, what would you suggest in when we're deciding to vote on a candidate, what we look for proof that this candidate will, when the hard laws come in that they have to vote on, what is the proof that they will enact good environmental legislation?
Their record. I mean, it really, past is prologue to the future. And it is not hard to measure the records of my colleagues in the Senate who are running, or a governor, or anybody else who's running. And you can take a look. Now, if they have no experience, then You have to measure that against what you're comfortable with, what's your comfort level. But the bottom line is very simple. You can measure what a candidate has fought for, what they have introduced as legislation, what they have co-sponsored as legislation, what they voted for, and measure some of their opposition and see what kind of arguments they made in opposition to certain things. And you'll get a pretty good sense of where their records are and what they're more likely to do or not do. In addition to that, I'm confident that in the 08 cycle, you're going to have a pretty strong environmental platform by a number of candidates, because I think a lot of us are working at raising the profile of this issue so that it is very much on the table. Can I do one thing? You know, it occurred to me when I was sitting there, I did not finish a thought, I'm going to take 1 minute to finish a thought. When I was talking to you about the 370 parts per million that we've now gotten up to, I didn't close the loop on that about why it's a problem. And the reason is those 2,000 scientists have now gleaned from the feedback of Mother Earth herself, the feedback being they made a bunch of predictions. Ice is going to melt, species is going to do, forests are going to... Those predictions are coming true at a faster rate and in a greater quantity than they ever anticipated. The result is they are now saying, whereas 2 years ago they said we could tolerate a 3-degree centigrade rise in Earth's temperature without getting to the point of tipping point, of catastrophe, and that would take us to 550 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That's what it was 2 years ago. No, no longer, folks. The feedback is coming so voraciously that they have changed their allowable level to 2 degrees centigrade rise that is allowable, and 450 parts per million. Why is that critical? Well, if you're at 370 now, and we went up from 270 to 370, and your allowable is 450, but you're about to triple the amount of emissions that you put into the atmosphere, you have very little cushion here in which to operate. We are at 0.8 degrees rise in temperature already over the last 100 plus whatever years since we've measured. The amount of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases already up in the atmosphere have a life that goes on called a half-life. And 80 years, 100 years, more than 100 years for some of them. So what we've already put up there is going to continue to do damage no matter what happens. And that's going to rise the temperature another 0.8 degrees, so it takes you to 1.4, 1.56. That leaves you a cushion of about 0.5 degrees. That's why it is so critical to stop the pulverized coal plants and get a cap on emissions. And that's what a bunch of us are working on, is a cap so that we, all of us, all the industrialized world, all the less developed countries, everybody is developing according to the new technologies. And that's a thought that was important to try to complete so everybody understands why this is really pressing and urgent as an issue. Yes?
Okay. I'll try to speak loudly. I don't need a mic.
It's coming.
Okay. Thank you. Two questions that are kind of different. The cigarette is certainly an instrument of toxin too, and tobacco is an important crop in Pennsylvania. So if do you think that there's the possibility of using tobacco in a non-toxic way, creating even a non-toxic, non-nicotine-based cigarette? And if there is no possibility, isn't this an area, an arena for some moral leadership to work on? And my other question has to do with our highway system and the future of the car, since our highway system is partly the legacy of Republicans and Eisenhower. Do we need the car, and should we be thinking beyond even just fuel alternatives for the car?
Well, both very fair questions. Let me, do you want to, I'll try to deal very quickly with both of them. saw me get my clue. I read the language there. For a long time, cigarette makers have been looking at ways of trying to create a cigarette that's non-toxic, and they haven't found a way yet. It's pretty hard, because if you are smoking for the purpose you're smoking, it's usually to get the nicotine hit. And if you're putting smoke in your lungs, it ain't good for you. It's a pretty simple equation. And remember, folks, how long they lied to us. That's a powerful word, but it's true. Absolutely proven. The tobacco settlements, which produced billions of dollars, came about because the companies lied. And the memorandum and all the court cases showed how they had lied to us. So I value, look, I understand, in Connecticut, in Massachusetts, in Western Massachusetts, we actually produce tobacco. A lot of people don't know that. It's a big crop in the Pioneer Valley along the Connecticut River. And the tobacco leaves are good enough from there, they actually go down to Dominican Republic. And they're used as the wrappers on Dominican Republic cigars. So it is a crop that's important. I understand it. I'm for doing what we've been doing over the last years, which is putting a pretty high tax on it, not being bashful about how high we tax it as a source of income to pay for the costs that we pay in society and so forth. But I'm not for banning it like a lot of other substances, because it's going to sell on the black market no matter what. And there's even a fine line between how much you tax and where you begin to create a black market anyway, just to avoid the tax. So, you know, I think you try to do what? You try to educate people to the best of your ability, get out there and make sure people understand, and in the end, if they make that choice, it's sort of like bungee jumping without the bungee tied to the, you know, whatever, or other things people choose to do. There are certain individual, you know, choices people have a right to make, I guess, in the end. As long as we've done our best to educate them about the consequences and to try to negate the willingness and ability to do it. Now, what's interesting is we have significantly altered behavior in our country with respect to smoking, and significantly altered behavior with respect to drinking, which raises a significant question as to why we can't do a better job, and this is a complete tangent, about other drugs, which we don't educate a lot of people about and put as much energy into. But there's been a huge change, a sea change, in the behavior of Americans in terms of smoking and even drinking nowadays. Now, on the subject of automobiles, I have been a passionate advocate for years about mass transit systems, partly because I lived abroad for a period of time and know what a delight it is to jump on a train in some other countries and get from point A to point B. And I take the Amtrak whenever I can here. I think the trip from Washington to New York is, you know, just a lot easier when you can walk into the station, get on, plug in your computer, sit there, work all the way up, and you're in the middle of the city and you don't waste an hour going to the station, you know, going to the airport and flying for an hour if there aren't delays, and then another hour to get in from where you are. And the difference in end time is not large. If we could make that more competitive in more parts of the country, more people would choose to do it. And I did have a plan. Had I been elected, it was going to be really one of the major legacy projects I wanted to produce, which was a true high-speed rail on the East Coast and West Coast, and certainly to Chicago or somewhere, certain sections across the country. Now, does that mean you got to get rid of the car? I say no. Americans, we have a love affair with the car. Everybody does. And there's certain parts of the country where you simply can't get where you're going, and you never will be able to. But you have to have a balance between how many cars are on the road and how people move and get to and fro without it. And if cars are clean, there's nothing to stop a soccer mom from piling the entire team into her SUV as long as the car is efficient. Now, I believe we will come up with engines that are not fossil fuel based within a few years, or engines that are so much more efficient that we're going to reduce this issue, because they'll be biofuel or hydrogen or some other source of energy for them. And so we're still going to have that ability. That doesn't mean, no matter what happens in terms of source of fuel, we got a bigger problem, which is most of our highways are moving, barely moving parking lots. And we have to find a more efficient way to use time and to help people be able to move from point A to point B. And it seems to me that best way is with an intelligent, high-speed and light rail system and other kinds of public transport that you actually enjoy getting on it. It's clean, it's efficient, it's on time and safe, and you can work or do whatever you do, make a phone call, even get a snack, do things while you're moving. If you did that, a lot more people would choose the alternative in order to be able to go from point A to point B. We don't invest in it, folks.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.